This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
From the Book of Serenity, Case 74, Fayan's Substance and Name, the Pointer. Plenty has myriad virtues, swept clear, there's not a mote of dust, detached from all forms, identical to all things, taking a step atop the 100-foot pole, the universe in all directions is one's whole body. But tell me, where does it come from? The main case. A student asked Master Fayan, I hear that in the teachings there's a saying, from a non-abiding basis are established all things. What is the non-abiding basis? Fayan said, form arises before substantiation. Name arises from before naming. The poem. Without tracks, no news. The white clouds are rootless. What color is the pure breeze? Spreading the canopy of the sky, mindless. Holding the carriage of the earth, powerful. Illumining the profound source of 1,000 ages, making patterns for 10,000 forms. Meetings for enlightenment in the atoms of all lands. In each place is Samantabhadra. The door of the tower opens. Everywhere is Maitreya.
Last Sunday, I gave a talk that focused on Huai Nung, the sixth ancestor, and his story, and about how he is presented in the tradition as evidence of what this teaching is really all about, and that it's so. Here was someone who had none of the signs of a potential Buddha at the time that he was living, a practitioner who could realize wisdom. He was poor, he was illiterate, he was not ordained, he was not sophisticated or learned. And at a time when many of the monastics, monks, were very learned, were coming from I don't know how they would have regarded the class at that time, but, you know, from upper classes, were intellectually and artistically also trained. And so here was somebody who had none of that and who gained enlightenment, as a way of saying that it's not about that. It's not about having wealth. It's not about having, you know, college degrees. It's not about financial success or the normal signs of worldly success, that it's really about practice and awakening to the Buddha mind that each and every one of us possesses. And that's all true. And at the same time, this Dharma, as the Buddha said upon his own enlightenment, is subtle, it's profound, it's difficult to not only perceive with our senses, but it is a challenge for us as practitioners to understand these teachings. They're difficult teachings, right? Because they're talking about very deep matters. And so while it doesn't require high education or, you know, backgrounds of wealth or privilege or affluence, it does require that we engage the teachings thoughtfully, carefully, that we spend time trying to understand what these teachings are saying. And in the beginning, that means, you know, with our rational mind, intellectually, so that we can begin to grasp that. And the purpose of that is so that we can begin to have faith in the teachings. It means that we have to engage in the many metaphors and examples, similes that are used throughout the history of Buddhism as a way to try and convey how do those teachings appear, like how do you make sense of that, right, in this physical world of ours. And so it does require that we do that. And I say all of that because this koan is kind of like that. It is challenging. It's the language itself is not necessarily immediately apparent. What is he talking about? What's being communicated at a deeper level is difficult to realize and difficult, and less so, but still difficult to understand. And so it does require that we engage it. And, you know, I've often said around the study that there's so much available to us these days in terms of Dharma teachings and texts and so on. And there's a great deal that's, you know, being presented in our, you know, by contemporary teachers and in our own language and in ways that are quite accessible, and that's good. But it's also, I think it's important to not limit ourselves to those kinds of teachings. We need to engage these teachings that are ancient and that are challenging. And foremost, that's because of what's being communicated. It's also because it's language. It's language from different times, where part of it is understanding what do these words mean within the context of Buddhism, what are these ideas that are being communicated in terms of Buddhism, and so on. So that's a prelude to invite you into that process. So this Master Phayon was asked by a student, I hear that in the teachings there's a saying, from a non-abiding place all things are established. From a place in which nothing dwells, everything comes forward. So all things return to the one. What does the one come from? If God, in a God-based world, is the source of all of creation, where did God come from? Well, God-based religions have to answer that. Was, will be, and always has been. But how do we understand that in Buddhism? If the 10,000 things of all phenomenal universe, everything we can perceive with our senses, returns to some basic space, where does that basic space come from? What is it? And Phayon says, form arises before substantiation. Names arise from before naming. Another old master from a different tradition, Tibetan Buddhist tradition, in the Dzogchen teachings, spoke of it this way. Within the expanse of spontaneous presence is the ground for all that arises. Empty in essence, continuous by nature. It has never existed as anything whatsoever, and yet arises as anything at all, as everything. Within the expanse of the three kayas, the three bodies of the Buddha, although samsara and nirvana arise naturally, they do not stray from this basic space. Such is the blissful realm that is the true nature of phenomena. And then the commentary on that says, thus, given that awareness is pure by nature, awareness is pure by its very nature, its essence as emptiness is what we call the Dharmakaya, the body of the Buddha, the reality body. Its nature as lucidity, as clarity, as radiance, is Sambhogakaya, the body of bliss of the Buddha. And the way in which its innate responsiveness arises is what we call the Nirmanakaya, the body of the Buddha that appears in the world, like Shakyamuni. He says, this great undiminishing treasure is the utterly lucid mandala that abides as the ground of being. Even as anything at all arises within that context, be it awareness's own manifestations as perceived purely by Buddhas or as perceived impurely by ordinary beings, all of it is only the display of basic space as the true nature of phenomena. We just are completing a retreat called Basic Space that is really drawing from these teachings. And so these bodies of the Buddha, the emptiness, which is the nature of all things, which is your basic nature, is the nature of every conceivable and inconceivable thing, is the Dharmakaya, is the body of the Buddha. How that manifests in form, in a natural radiance and luminosity, in lucidity, is its Sambhogakaya, the body that manifests all of the virtues of the enlightened nature. And its responsiveness, how it responds to the world, to circumstances, to people, to the cries, is the Nirmanakaya, the manifesting body of the Buddha. And so what this is showing is this inseparable, intimate relationship between not only form and emptiness, the absolute and the relative, the fundamental and the phenomenal, right? Your essential nature, the ground of being and everyday life, but also between that fundamental nature, that basic space, and compassion. That everything arises out of that essential nature, and its nature of arising is compassion in the human realm. And that's why wisdom and compassion are not two. They can't be separated. So as Dai Roshi used to often say, wisdom without compassion is not true wisdom, and compassion without wisdom is not true compassion. And so here Fayan says, in terms of what is the abiding basis, where does it come from? Fayan says, form arises before substantiation, names arise from before naming. So what he's drawing upon here, form and name, is a very basic teaching in Buddhism. Right, nama rupa. Nama is name, rupa is form. And in the 12-fold chain of dependent origination, the Buddha's teaching on how, when we begin from delusion, when we begin from just not seeing things clearly, how does that move towards suffering, right, in every possible form? How does that work? How does that happen? And so this teaching that the Buddhism says came out of the Buddha's enlightenment, scholars say probably developed in time, doesn't matter really. Name and form is the fourth link, and so it begins with delusion. And then there's karmic formations, in other words, based in the way we see things, we think. We have desires, we act, we create karma. And so these karmic formations arise out of delusion. And then that, and this is also within the teachings of rebirth, that creates consciousness. So there is someone, the sense of consciousness, who is doing all of this. And then that leads to the physical reality that we call you and me. And so those are the precursors to birth from a Buddhist perspective. And that birth occurs when consciousness enters into an embryo or a seed, an egg, and only in that way is consciousness and form come together can there be human life. Consciousness can also be understood as, or name and form can also be understood in terms of the skandhas, form, feeling, coming in contact with things, the sensations that arise out of that, our mental formations, what we do, how we respond to that, and then consciousness. And so what he's saying is that form, that which we are, form is everything material, our whole material world, arises before substantiation, before it becomes substantiated. What does that mean? That name is everything mental. We could think of it as everything mental. It is your name. It is what we call things. It's our labeling of things, which so comes in our mind to define things, which is part of the reason why names are so important, why names have so much meaning, because that meaning becomes part of one's identity, right? Forms arise before substantiation. The footnote says, don't hallucinate. Names arise before naming. The footnote says, what can you call it after all? As Longchen Rabjan, the quote I read earlier, says, empty in essence, it has never existed as anything whatsoever, yet arises as everything. And arises as everything. Because it has never existed as anything, it can arise as everything. And so what does this mean? Why is this important, right? These teachings are not just for intellectual, you know, pleasure. They're not just to expound some deep truth. They're to be studied. They're to be practiced. They're to be realized. They're speaking about the very nature of our lives as they're happening, right? So this is not just talking about what happens once we're enlightened. It's talking about what's happening at every moment, whether we see it or not, whether we're aware of it or not, whether we care or not. It is the inner workings of things. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, and so these are different teachers, different teachings, different traditions within the Buddhist tradition that are speaking of this non-abiding basis. And I'm bringing these out just so that we can see how within Mahayana Buddhism these teachings appear. Right, the importance of this essential question, of this non-abiding basis, not dwelling in anything. And so Manjushri in the Vimalakirti Sutra asks Vimalakirti, what is the great compassion of a bodhisattva? And Vimalakirti says, it's giving all of your accumulated virtues to other beings. And Manjushri says, what's the great joy of the bodhisattva? And Vimalakirti says, it's to be joyful and without regret in giving. It's to give everything and to be without regret. In fact, to be joyful. And then he asks, what is the equanimity of the bodhisattva? And Vimalakirti says, it's what benefits both self and others. It's like speaking about the immeasurables, four immeasurables. It's what benefits both self and others. That's what brings equanimity. And then Manjushri says, well, what should we resort to when terrified by the fear of life? When the very presence and fact of life itself brings us fear. To what then do you turn? Where do you turn? What do you take refuge in? Vimalakirti says, a bodhisattva who is terrified of life should resort to the magnanimity of the Buddha, the great heart, the great generosity. Interesting. Would you have thought that on your own? Would we think that? Would be a logical connection. When terrified by fear, turn towards the deep generosity of the Buddha. But you have that heart. I have that heart. And then he goes on, well, to one who resorts to that magnanimity, where should you stand? Where do you put yourself? Right? How do you sort of position yourself as you're doing that? And he said, you should stand in equanimity. Stand in equanimity towards all beings. And he says, well, where should you stand to do that? Where do you put yourself? Where do you find yourself? And Vimalakirti says, you should live for the liberation of all beings. In other words, when terrified by life, cultivate generosity. How do you do that? By finding equanimity within your own mind. Right? Because when we're terrified of life, we are not in equanimity. We're in a turbulent state, agitated state. We're easily caught up in things. We're easily turned around. It's very difficult to see things clearly. But then how do we do that? How do we find that equanimity. He says, let your life be for the welfare of others, which is wonderful, isn't it? In that moment when we would be so consumed about ourselves, he says, let that be so large that it includes everyone. And then Manjushri says, well, what should one who wishes to liberate all beings do? Now what? And Vimalakirti says, well, liberate them from their passions, free them from everything that entangles them. Right? Every thought, every emotion, every desire. Now, of course, when he's talking about them, liberate them, he's also implicit within that, is you. You, the one who's doing all these things. Me, the one who is terrified by life, who is turning towards the magnanimity of the Buddha, who is standing in equanimity, who is liberating all beings, including myself, from all of my attachments. And then Manjushri says, well, how do you apply yourself as you're doing that? And Vimalakirti says, appropriately. which can sound very superficial, but appropriate means in perfect accord, in complete harmony, meeting this as it is, in perfect harmony. It's not like social etiquette kind of appropriate. Although sometimes that's in accord with. And then he says, how do you apply yourself appropriately? And Vimalakirti says, don't produce anything and don't destroy anything. And Manjushri says, well, what should I not produce? What should I not destroy? And Vimalakirti says, don't produce anything harmful and don't destroy anything good. And Manjushri says, well, what's the root of all of this good and evil? And Vimalakirti says, form. Everything that you see, everything that you touch, everything that you hear, everything that you taste. Your physical body, the physical bodies of all beings. Everything material is the root of all good and evil. And he says, what? What is the root of that? A form. And Vimalakirti says, desire. What's the root of desire? And he says, unreal mental constructions. Constructions in our mind that are not real. And that may be because the construction itself, what it's about, is false. If we form an idea, an opinion, we have a view that's just not true. But it could be a construction that is based in something that is true, but the construction itself is not real, meaning it has no solidity. It's just something, a kind of energetic appearance in our mind. Even as anything at all arises within, be it awareness's own manifestations coming from pure perception or from impure perception, this is only the display of basic space as the true nature of phenomena. What's the root of an unreal mental construction? And Vimalakirti says, a false concept, a false view. And Manjushri says, what's the root of a false view? And Vimalakirti says, non-abiding. Manjushri says, what's the root of non-abiding? And Vimalakirti says, Manjushri, when something is non-abiding, it can't have any root. It has no basis. There is no ground. And everything stands on this, non-abiding. Things can only arise from this non-abiding, which means compassion, which means everything good. It means also all of suffering. And so in the pointer, he says, plenty has myriad virtues. So as things arise, the world is filled with myriad virtues. It's also filled with sickness, old age, and death. It's filled with oppression and injustice and inequality. All of that arises from the same basis, from the same non-dwelling, Non-abiding is the basis of all compassion and suffering, all of our sorrows, all of our joys, all of our delusions, all of our enlightenment. And so understanding this, so think about being in our world when we encounter hatred, hateful words, hateful thoughts, hateful views, hateful actions, people who are filled with hatred. To understand these as impure perceptions, false mental constructions arising out of unwholesome desires, as the Buddha would speak of them, based in false ideas that rest in non-abiding, that have no ground. It's the stuff that dreams are made of. That's why there's so many references to this world of ours as dreamlike, as illusory. Not to deny that it's happening, certainly not to deny that the effects of actions do cause harm, and the effects of other actions liberate us. That's why the Buddha taught. That's why Buddhism exists. It's for that very reason. But how do we manifest compassion and not get so entangled within the disturbance in our mind that comes forth from other people's disturbances? How do we not create disturbances in our own mind that other people then get caught up in? And so this is why the heart of compassion is wisdom, that the heart of practice is always this non-abiding basis. And to get to the root. But how can you get to non-abiding? Right? It has no address. It has no place. It appears only as form. It has no other appearance. It can't appear except in something, as something. But how can you stand on the root which is baseless, as Vimalakirti said? Well, if that seems abstract, just turn it around. How can you get to abiding? How do you stand on that? Well, that's easy, right? Just stand in that place that is fixed, where it seems permanent, where things are defined by the way they appear, where things have their own power. They have the power to give you ultimate happiness, or they have the power to give you lasting pain and suffering, where they are not you, separate from you, and so you have to be busy about getting them. They can hurt you, and so you have to be busy about keeping your distance. But have we ever found a single thing that has that nature? We certainly have experienced a lot of the symptoms, you might say. The happiness, the pain, but neither of those last. Neither of those, when we look closely, come under their own power. What we see in every conceivable way when we look is that in whatever way we create distance, we create suffering. And that suffering is equal to the distance. When I was living in New York, Jimon and I had an apartment around from the temple, and our upstairs neighbors was a couple. Both of them were teachers, and one of them taught, he did a lot of work at the UN, even though he was a university professor in New York City, and his area of expertise was basically it was ethical warfare, which is already challenge, but what he was focusing on was the use of robotics and drones in warfare specifically, and that they were trying to, as I remember, they were trying to sort of add something to the Geneva Convention or something that would be adhered to by all nations who go to war, which was that no robotic fighting anything could be self-driven. In other words, that every action by any machine that was designed to kill had to be moment by moment driven by a human being. In other words, a human being has to be responsible for taking other human beings' lives. So, that comes to mind when I think of how the greater the distance, the greater the suffering. Because it distances us from that very suffering. The more that distance dissolves, the greater the happiness. And that's why saturated within the sense of self, in ourselves and other things, when we enter into training, we engage this, what's Bodhidharma called, a special transmission outside the sutras. And special here doesn't mean special to Zen, it means special in the sense of life-giving. Beyond the realm of words and ideas, these very words themselves are intended through practice to take us, to free us of the word, these words, and to bring us into that very place that they speak of, so that we can directly encounter the nature of mind and enlightenment. And so what does this non-abiding basis mean? Let go. Let go. Let go still more. Any subtle sign of anything can be held on to. Any subtle sign of anything can be released. And so as long as we're still in that realm of capture and release, then we're still in a world where there are threats and there's a distancing ourselves from those threats. And so in all things, apply yourself appropriately. And so to practice non-abiding is to be in the world in a way that is true to the world. It is the very nature of things, that the nature of all things do not abide. And because of that non-abiding, they appear. There's a passage in the Vimalakirti Diamond Sutra that says you should enliven your mind without dwelling on anything. Not dwelling on anything means don't dwell on form, don't dwell on sound, don't dwell on delusion, don't dwell on enlightenment, don't dwell on essence, don't dwell on function. Enlivening the mind means dwelling. Enlivening mind means manifesting one mind in every place, in every moment. If you enliven the mind dwelling on good, goodness appears. If you enliven the mind dwelling on evil, evil appears. The basic mind is concealed. If it doesn't dwell on anything, anywhere, then the whole world is realized as one mind. Avalokiteshvara realizes all beings are one essence. All beings have one nature. All beings arise from non-abiding. And so practice is really just that. In Zazen, in walking, in eating, in listening to Atesha, in studying the Dharma, in having insight, in noticing a moment where you respond differently, more compassionately, with more wisdom, when you enter into some deeper state in your meditation. Not dwelling in good, not dwelling in bad. You know, when we practice together, particularly when we practice intensively, it's natural to feel moments of positive states in body and mind, to feel more intimately connected, to experience our lives in a different way. It's like feeling the warmth of a fire on a cold night. To abide in that is like getting up, taking the burning log, and lighting the drapes on fire. Before you know it, the whole house is burning. Right? So that warmth suddenly becomes a problem. Non-abiding is non-abiding, not dwelling. If you don't dwell on anything anywhere, then the whole world is one mind. And it's so difficult to not abide in things when it seems like we need to, right? Because they're so important. And so importance means, doesn't mean to abide, doesn't mean to give it our attention. It doesn't mean not to engage. It means to engage. It means to engage wholeheartedly. Wholeheartedly means not abiding. Means without residue, without traces. It means completely, without anything left out, like the self, like hidden motives and agendas, like expectations. And so in this retreat, to practice within time, in the morning, within periods of zazen, marking the day, this is the time to sit. This is the time to walk. This is the time to eat. Right? And to let go of that marking. So there is no name and form. You're not labeling that. You're not narrating that as you go. It's just zazen. There is no before or after. It's just one mind. And then there is walking. There is no zazen. There is no afternoon. There is no shower. There's just walking. That's your universe. It's one mind. And then it's a shower. It's not zazen. It's not walking. It's just water. And so this moment is the moment of practice. To begin awake, to end awake, to let go throughout, to be non-dwelling. And then in the afternoon during this retreat, then there is no demarcation of time. Right? There is no time to sit, no time to walk, no time to eat. There is no breaking up of the day. There is no order. There's no routine. What is it then? It's just this moment is this practice. You begin awake, you end awake, you let go. Don't divide, don't dwell. In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, it says over and over again, it basically goes through all of the different essential aspects of Buddha's practice and teaching, like the Eightfold Path, which consists of right view, right intention, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. What is right view? It asks, and the Buddha says, here a bodhisattva who practices within perfect wisdom develops right view as a limb of the path, as an essential part of the path, based upon non-attachment, letting go of the passions, letting go of producing and destroying, and dedicated to realizing the self is empty. And so on for the other aspects of the Eightfold Path. And at every step, not apprehending, non-apprehension, not obtaining, not appropriating, not establishing, not knowing. That is the great revolution of the middle way. That is the ultimate, in a sense, the only challenge that Buddha Dharma presents us with. So at any moment when suffering arises, no matter how subtle, we know that there's some form of grasping. But another way of looking at that is that there's something that we're dwelling in that moment. There's some way in which the self has been established and is dwelling in something. Now, there's going to be a reason why. And that reason has validity. We call that karma. And that reason will have something to do with you, and it will also have something to do with larger than you, right? Because nobody is born into or lives in a vacuum. We live in a world in which we're continually impacting on each other in ways that are positive and ways that are harmful. And the ways in which we're experiencing that are not equal. And so what this is, in a sense, this is not judging that fact, right? That the more deluded we are, the worse of a human being. The Buddhism doesn't teach that. What it does teach is the more deluded we are, right? As we go in, we see the more ramped up and fierce are our desires, the more tenacious and righteous are our views. And yet, all of that sits on the ground of not dwelling, not abiding. And as we move out, that will create more and more chaos. And that our very being will also be in some state of chaos. And so what it does is, in a way that's kind of reporting the news for us to know, for those who want to tune in, this is what's happening. This is the news for today, right? In case you want to know. In case you might want to respond. In case you might want to do something about that. Who the person is arising out of that basic space is never in question. Right? There has never been there has been a debate of whether there's a certain type of being and whether that type of being has Buddha nature. The being is called an achantika, and it's a particularly not good guy kind of being, right? Who is so kind of turned inside out in delusion and evil that there were debates in ancient times as to whether even this kind of being has Buddha nature. Right? But pretty much the decision was, yeah, they have to. But that isn't debated. It's not even not debated. It's not a thing that forms into a question. It's not a thing that is thought or talked about. Because from the very beginning, it was established, seen as true. And so everything, and that's why it's so important to practice not dwelling in judgments. We have to be able to see the difference between right and wrong, between what's helpful and not helpful, between what is a quality and not a quality, justice and injustice. We have to. But the great challenge is to do that, and to do that with urgency and commitment, and to not dwell. To not establish ourself, our identity, our right view, to establish our view of injustice within a fixed state, which then becomes something which is no longer justice, but something else. Somebody once asked an old master, where does the rain come from? And the master says, it comes from your question. Where does the pain come from? The pain that you experience, it comes from your experience of that pain. And that pain is an intimate contact, an intimate interrelatedness with all things. That's why it doesn't reject the causes of that pain. And that's very difficult for us to hold. How can that be true? Is it you or is it me? So when we hear that question and apply it to my pain, right, which may be a result of something that you have done, or your pain that may be a result of something that I have done, we can flop onto one side or the other. Well, it's just my mind that's doing this. But that's not true. Or it's just what you did, but that's not true either. And it's not 50-50, it's not a blending, it's not a mixture. It's altogether something free of that, that only can be known in non-abiding, non-dwelling. So let me finish with a just a few lines from a poem of Master Dogen's from his fascicle, Lancet of Seated Meditation. The essential function of all the Buddhas, the functioning essence of all the ancestors. It is present without thinking. It is completed without interacting. Present without thinking, its presence is inherently intimate. There is no distance. Completed without interacting, its completion is inherently verified. You already know. Its presence is inherently intimate. It is ever without any stain or defilement. And every stain and defilement arises from this. And the implication of that is that because it arises from this, it can cease arising. In its arising and appearing so, that's not its basic nature. And that is the pathway into compassion. To meet things as they appear, because that's how we interact. That's how we experience the pain and suffering. And at the same moment to realize its nature is vast and boundless. It cannot be contained. It is not contained in that, the quality of that appearance. And to hold all of that as one unified being. And as the teaching on right effort says, is to try and ameliorate, to diminish, to calm all that is harmful, and to strengthen and bring forth all that is beneficial, seeing the totality at all times. And that takes a little bit of study and a bit of practice. More than we might think. Indeed, more than we think.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.